This year marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of the famed abolitionist Frederick Douglass. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery on a farm in Talbot County around 1818, eventually escaped in 1838. He's best known, probably, as being the abolitionist and civil rights leader of his time. But he did not forget the land that once enslaved him. With us this morning is John Muller. He's author of a book entitled Frederick Douglass in Washington, D.C., The Lion of Anacostia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Don.
So, well, first of all, how did you become involved in your interest with Frederick Douglass?
Sure. Well, I just wanted to give a quick acknowledgement to Delmarva Public Radio and Don. He has had on Linda Dwyer, who's also been involved in this research project. Linda's a wonderful local Eastern Shore historian. Maybe I'll answer your question two ways. In terms of Frederick Douglass, I worked for the United Planning Organization. I worked there almost a decade ago. They are the community action agency for Washington, D.C. They're involved in community outreach efforts in terms of job training, housing services, et cetera. So I worked on Good Hope Road, which is right around the corner from the Frederick Douglass House. And on my way to work, with the Metro walking to and from the Anacostia Station, I walk past the Douglass House every day. And a coworker of mine, there are lack of, food eateries in the neighborhood, so we would basically go to the Douglass House once a week, et cetera, just to kind of hang out because there's nothing really else to do. So I had read Frederick Douglass's 1845 narrative when I was in junior high school, and I was really taken back with them in terms of the intelligence that I perceived. I mean, I was reading about 12, 13 years old, and I was like, wow, this Frederick Bailey running the streets of Baltimore, trading food for spelling lessons. I was like, that's really interesting because I don't know if, I would do the same thing in terms of he's prioritizing education. So with that said, that seed had been planted when I was a youngster, but walking past the Douglass House, I'm kind of a naturally intellectually curious person. At that time, I had, this is back in like 2009, 2010, I was working as a journalist I worked as a journalist. So my friend asked one day, really, to the park rangers, well, what did Frederick Douglass mean to this neighborhood? Where did he go to eat dinner? Who did he hang out with? What were the churches he frequented, etc.? And so this he essentially presented me with an ultimatum, said, John, you need to write about Frederick Douglass in Washington. I know you are a journalist and you like local history. So that was about a decade ago. The book came out in October of 2012, which is now 6 years ago. So it's had time to kind of germinate, marinate, percolate out there in the, in Washington. People take Frederick Douglass very seriously in terms of the Anacostia neighborhood. There are a lot of people who regard themselves as guardians of the history in Anacostia. And in about the last year or so, I've started to spend more time on the Eastern Shore. And so I've been investigating his time, Frederick Douglass's visits to the Eastern Shore, which are more frequent than what has been told. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But on the Eastern Shore, there are also guardians of Frederick Douglass's history in terms of his extensive family network that remains on the Eastern Shore. So I've really tried to be sensitive to this history because I'm just like a historian and there are guardians of the history. And so Frederick Douglass is just such a consequential figure in United States history. But for us here in the Eastern Shore in Washington, it's more of a local history. And so that's kind of the way that I approach Frederick Douglass.
Let me ask you, so we've heard a lot about, and we'll get and talk about his experiences here on the Eastern Shore, but what was his life like? When did he live in Washington, D.C., and what was his life like?
Sure. It was well known, and this question was asked at the presentation Friday the 21st in Cambridge. Someone asked in the kind of question and answer session about Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And so, Frederick Douglass's relationship, his meetings with President Lincoln are well known. Douglass was an activist leading up to the Civil War. And during the Civil War, he was a recruiter. His children served in the Union or the United States Colored Troops. So after the Civil War, Douglass's children moved to Washington, his three boys. Frederick Jr. Is working for the Treasury Department. Lewis is working for the Government Printing Office. And Charles Douglass is actually working for the Freedmen's Bureau for the brother of Oliver Otis Howard, who Howard University is named after. So the story of Douglass coming to Washington is really a family affair in terms of Douglass's three children are in Washington. It's the mechanics of Reconstruction legislation are happening. And so his children writing to Frederick, to their father, saying, hey, Dad, you have to come down to Washington. This is where all the action is. Douglas launches a newspaper January 13, 1870. That's really kind of what starts his close affiliation with Washington. He was living in Rochester at that time. Douglas was, as we all know, very active. He traveled the entire country, the world, really. And he formally moves to Washington or buys property on Capitol Hill in 1872 on A Street, which is right behind the Supreme Court. Then in 1877, actually right around the time that Frederick Douglass purchases his property in Cedar Hill in Anacostia, he is visiting Cambridge. It's really just kind of an interesting confluence of events. But Douglass lives in Cedar Hill in Anacostia from 1877 until his death in 1895. So that's kind of that's just a quick chronology. And what's really interesting is while Douglass is living in Washington, you know, he makes multiple visits to the Eastern Shore. And I think a lot of these you know, Douglass was someone who claimed a lot of places, or people now today, a lot of places claim him historically. And he has a footprint in so many different places. And what's really interesting with, if I may, I guess, say this, and not to cause controversy, but the acknowledgement recognition of Harriet Tubman is wonderful, and I'm really learning more about that as I'm spending more time on the shore. But it's really interesting in terms of there are buildings, there are many buildings, churches, courthouses, et cetera, that Frederick Douglass visited on the Eastern Shore that are, you know, fortunately still with us today. So it's just trying to elevate and uplift the history is really kind of what, you know, my mission.
By the way, Douglass, obviously they come into to Washington after the Civil War, and we know that there was this period of Reconstruction, but Reconstruction ends around 1877, right, after the Great Compromise, Presidential Compromise. What was his life like in terms of that struggle for Reconstruction, but do you ever get a sense from what his writings are that there was any disappointment as things began to change, that bright moment when all things could be solved, suddenly that door closed?
That's a wonderful question, Don. The election of 1876 between Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes, Frederick Douglass does play an oversized role, or in terms of the national consequence of his appointment. Frederick Douglass is appointed United States Marshal of the District of Columbia in March of 1877. And close student scholars of Reconstruction will know that Frederick Douglass's appointment as Marshal was essentially a negotiating piece in terms of the Compromise of 1877, which you mentioned, which I will not get into all the nitty-gritty. But in terms of Douglass was... his position as marshal was extremely prominent. And so Douglass kind of, I don't want to get into speculation because a lot of scholars do that in terms of I could never walk in Frederick Douglass's shoes, but studying him, he had very complex relationships, dynamics as being essentially a radical, an activist who then becomes in position of power. I mean, Frederick Douglass, we all know, was, you know, a fugitive slave or runaway slave. That's kind of how he came up. And marshals, United States marshals were trusted or legislated. They enforced the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. So Douglass was familiar with the role of marshals, but he is appointed marshal. And I'll just quickly say this quote, what's really interesting is in the New York Evangelist in April of, I think Linda might have read this, okay, but the New York Evangelist in April of 1877, there was a little small item, and it said that an ex-constable was at the criminal court in Washington the other day. A bailiff saw him and said, "Sir, are you looking for Marshal Douglass?" He said, "No, not now, but there was a time when he was a fugitive when I tried hard to find him." So I think that kind of show that that quote is illustrative of kind of the complexities in terms of duality, I guess, that Douglass plays, because he's a radical, he's an activist, yet he's also is in charge of enforcing the law. So to kind of try to more directly answer your question, Reconstruction is very complicated. Charles Sumner, who was a senator from Massachusetts, who Douglass was a close ally with, he dies in 1874. They have the civil rights legislation, that kind of the first generation of civil rights legislation that's passed in the 1870s. There's a Supreme Court decision in 1883 that essentially reverses the anti-discrimination laws of the Civil Rights Act. So you have the segregation that happens in schools and streetcars, etc. So Douglass like you said, he worked hard to enact change. He saw the change on the precipice, and then it rolled back. And then there was an article just the other day in the Baltimore Sun about lynchings. Now, Frederick Douglass was later in his life, towards the last year of his life, he was outspoken against lynching. So he saw the rollback, essentially, of civil rights enforcement for African-Americans. And I think, you know, Douglass saw the promise in America. I read this recently somewhere. It's a great quote. I think he saw the promise in America and fought to make America live up to its promise, but maybe was disheartened with some of the things that happened, and we're, you know, still there's still things going on today. So we're still kind of trying to fight for the same liberties that Douglass fought for in his life.
One of the principles, I ran across a quote, he says that Douglass says that if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Do you think that was the essence of his life?
Exactly, and that really can be taken as just in terms of people's personal lives. You know, sometimes people struggle with self. Sometimes people struggle within the family. People struggle. You know, Douglass lived a very public life, and he had many contemporaries that he, you know, just struggled with in terms of whether they were Southern sympathizing senators, congressmen, that were former Confederates who were in the United States Congress. Douglass had to compromise with them in terms of that's a very complicated situation in terms of this Douglass was he was someone that we celebrate him for his role as his quote is agitate, agitate, agitate. And, you know, there's a real thin line between what people are comfortable with in terms of agitation and what people will receive warmly. And so there's always a struggle. There's always a need for progress. And so I think that's a great, just code to live by.
He seemed to actually capture when he was talking about Lincoln and talk a little bit about Lincoln. He said that though Mr. Lincoln shared the prejudices of his white fellow countrymen against the Negro, it is hardly necessary to say that his heart of hearts, he loathed and hated slavery. He seemed to recognize that there was a duality that to that struggle against, on the one hand, slavery, but nonetheless recognizing the racial component lived on.
Right. Douglass really... he's someone I guess quickly mention. I'm doing some things about some talks about Douglass and Lincoln. My friend, my classmate at George Washington University, Paul Kendrick, him and his father wrote a book on Douglass and Lincoln. It's a wonderful book. I suggest people maybe take a look for it. Douglass was known for his relationships and associations with radicals like John Brown, as well as President Lincoln. And he was frequently, people wrote to Douglass asking him to contribute essays about his memories, his recollections of President Lincoln in 1876. It's well known. Douglass makes a speech in a park in Washington and kind of recalls Douglass. And like you said, Douglass was someone who his voice was respected as an authoritative voice, and his associations with presidents lasted from Abraham Lincoln to President Harrison when Douglass died. So just to answer your question about Douglass and Lincoln, Lincoln was a giant in American history, and as well, Douglass is a giant in American history.
So after the Civil War, he, as you mentioned, seems to come back to his home, that is the Eastern Shore. Tell me a little bit about that. And it seems as if by that time he's beginning to at least soften in a sense of understanding or trying to heal, perhaps, the nation that had been so divided.
Right. That's a great question, Don. So 1877 is a very... consequential year in American history. Just kind of to say modern times, 1968, a lot of people look back in 1968. So 1877 is the year that you have President Hayes becomes the 19th president. The Reconstruction is essentially over, or people, you know, historians will look to 1877 as that year. So Douglass, as someone who is of national consequence, he makes one very, very public, well-known visit back to the Eastern Shore. In June of 1877, Frederick Douglass returns to St. Michael's. This is the time Frederick Douglass was in St. Michael's, Maryland, in Talbot County as an adolescent. His struggle with Covey was well-known. That was down in the St. Michael's area. But in June of 1877, when Douglass is marshal, he returns to today it's called the Dr. Dotson House, the Reconciliation House at Cherry and Locust Street. It's one block off of the main commercial strip in St. Michael's. Frederick Douglass returns and visits Captain Thomas Auld. Captain Thomas Auld was one of Frederick Douglass's owners during his life. Douglass, when he meets Auld, Auld is bedridden, and Auld greets Frederick Douglass as Marshal, which is very consequential in terms of the reconciliation is kind of on both sides. The Douglass's visit is written up in all of the local papers, the Baltimore Sun, the Evening Star. It is circulated throughout the country, really circulated throughout the world in terms of this meeting with Douglass. In terms of, it's a very personal meeting for Frederick Douglass. I think Douglass was very deliberate in what he did, and so it's an effort to Douglass's maybe putting some closure on his personal life, but it's symbolic for like closure of the country. And like I said, I'm really not big into speculation. I'm just a local historian, so this is a little like out of my league in terms of trying to speak in these just generalities. But at the same time, I think there's a real, real importance. Now, when Douglass visits Auld in June 1877, and Auld is buried in St. Michael's, Frederick Douglass makes a return visit to the Eastern Shore in September of 1877. Frederick Douglass, September 22, comes back to the Eastern Shore and visits Cambridge. When Frederick Douglass visits Cambridge, Maryland, in Dorchester County, he is in company with John Mercer Langston. John Mercer Langston was someone who was extremely consequential in his own right. John Mercer Langston was from Ohio. He was college educated. He was the dean of Howard University Law School. Mercer Langston later went on to serve as the he was the first black congressman from Virginia, but that was after their visit to Cambridge. But when Douglass and Langston come to Cambridge, and at this specific moment in time, John Mercer Langston's nomination to be ambassador to Haiti is in the United States Senate for review. Douglass's marshal has official, you know, patronage position, and Mercer Langston his patronage position is being reviewed. So the reason why this visit to Cambridge is so consequential, and since we're on TV, really want to give an acknowledgement quickly to the Star Democrat. They wrote a nice article. Douglass visited Cambridge in today's edition. The Star Democrat has done a wonderful job covering all the bicentennial events. But the reason why Douglass's visit in September of 1877, which has evaded the attention of scholars, of biographers, Douglass did not mention it in his own autobiographical writings. The reason why I interpret this visit to be so consequential is not only does the town of Cambridge, or the city of Cambridge, rather, excuse me, the city of Cambridge greet Frederick Douglass with an official proclamation welcoming Marshall Douglass. It was reprinted in the newspapers. There was a band that greeted Frederick Douglass. When John Mercer Langston and Frederick Douglass go around town, the band is kind of essentially escorting them, letting people know that you have some dignitaries in town. But Frederick Douglass, when he comes to Cambridge, he meets Henry Lloyd. Henry Lloyd was born in Cambridge in 1852. He was 25 in 1877. He was the son of Daniel Lloyd. Now, true Douglass scholars will know that Daniel Lloyd was the youngest son of Edward Lloyd V. Edward Lloyd V was the owner of Y House Plantation. Edward Lloyd V was the governor, senator, etc. His youngest son was Daniel Lloyd. Daniel Lloyd's born in 1812. Frederick Douglass tells in his narrative that when Frederick Douglass is removed from the Tuckahoe and brought to Y House when he's about 6-7 years old, he becomes the playmate, the body servant, the executive assistant of Daniel Lloyd. And Daniel Lloyd would go hunting. He would shoot the birds. Douglass would, at that time, Frederick Bailey would go, you know, find the birds, etc. And Daniel Lloyd would share his biscuits, his corn cakes, etc. with young Frederick Bailey, which Douglass fondly recalls in all of his autobiographical writings. And Douglass says that when he was on the lecture circuit, people would ask Frederick Douglass why he did not speak with the, let's say, broken diction of enslaved persons. And so Frederick Douglass would say, well, I must acknowledge my friend Daniel Lloyd, who's the governor's son. Daniel Lloyd was my playmate, and when I would associate with him, I would get his education. And Daniel Lloyd was such a close running mate with Frederick Bailey, that when guests would come to White House, and these are possibly, you know, judges, congressmen, business people, etc., Daniel Lloyd would say to young Frederick Bailey, hey, that's who this is, that's et cetera, et cetera. So Frederick Douglass was schooled to the ways of the world at the White House plantation, a very, you know, restrictive environment by Daniel Lloyd. And Daniel Lloyd dies in 1875. His son, Henry Lloyd, is here in Cambridge. So when Douglas comes back to Cambridge, he meets Henry Lloyd and says to Henry Lloyd, "I knew your father. He looked out for me. He meant a lot to me." In the accounts of the newspaper accounts of Douglas's visit to Cambridge, he specifically mentions the Lloyd family, specifically mentions the kindness that Daniel Lloyd showed to him. Daniel Lloyd is buried in Cambridge, as is Henry Lloyd. Henry Lloyd later would go on to serve as governor of the state of Maryland. So I think this is a reconciliation visit that has evaded the narrative, the history of Frederick Douglass. And I think it is extremely consequential, extremely important, not only to Frederick Douglass's just life story. I think this is really, I must acknowledge the Harriet Tubman Museum and Educational Center for allowing us to do the presentation that we did, because I think it's just very, very important. And, it's important to Frederick Douglass's life history that for whatever reasons not been told yet, but it's also a very important local history story. Because in terms of the connections that Douglas has with the Lloyds, and the Lloyds are here in Cambridge, buried here in Cambridge. Henry Lloyd was a Cambridge guy. So that's a long answer to your question in terms of the complexities of Douglas, let's say, reconciliation missions, brought him back to the shore, because Douglas, this is where he was from. This was his native soil. And just as there are, descendants of Frederick Bailey, the Bailey tribe. They're very deep and extensive all throughout the Eastern Shore. They're also, relatives of Douglas's, say, like, surrogate white family. And so I think that I'm not an Eastern Shoreman. I know the whole, come here sort of thing. So I just come here to try to share the history. So there's certain things I really am not in a position to speak on, whether from experience, education, et cetera. But I just think that, this story of Douglas in Cambridge is very important to Douglas scholars, historians, et cetera, but also a very important local story. And that's why I really appreciate you having me on, Don, on Delmarva Public Radio, to share this history, because I think it's history that the Eastern Shore owns. You guys claim it. It's your, it's your history. I'm just kind of like just here to spread the gospel.
Chronicle. Yeah. He also makes, by the way, a visit to Salisbury.
Exactly.
Tell me about that. And I understand that there's a report on it. I think there's a quote actually from one of the reporters who quotes him as saying in his speech in Salisbury that the 4 million of slaves in the United States, the date of the Emancipation Proclamation, were most intelligent, most happy, most healthy, and best looking 4 million of Negroes under the canopy of heaven. Apparently, a reporter took umbrage with that, to say the least. It was a white reporter. What do we make of his speech?
Well, I want to give a quick acknowledgement to Linda Dwyer. Linda Dwyer is someone who is a great local historian. She's been a groundbreaking historian here in Salisbury. I'm sure people listening know her work. I reached out to Linda a couple months ago because I had found her articles, I believe, in the Independent Times Dorchester Banner, maybe Dorchester Star, et cetera, local papers about Linda writing about Frederick Douglass's visit to Salisbury. And speaking at the Wicomico County Courthouse in February of 1880. And what's interesting in terms of, Linda has, she's the kind of person who put the information out there. But my interpretation of Douglass's visit to Salisbury is it's essentially his church network, his church affiliations. In terms of Douglass was well networked with, for example, Unitarians in Rochester. Grimke, who performed Douglass's second marriage, was a Presbyterian pastor. The AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, was a network that Frederick Douglass was closely affiliated with. Many reverends, Bishop Alexander Wayman, who quickly acknowledged was the seventh bishop of the AME Church. Frederick Douglass grew up with him. Bishop Wayman is from the Tuckahoe, from Caroline County side. But when Douglass visits Salisbury, he's essentially invited through his church network, and his speech, in terms of Douglass did this in many locations. When Douglass would lecture, for example, Douglass visits Hagerstown in 1879, and it's similar to Salisbury, Hagerstown, other locations. When Douglass would lecture, the proceeds would go to benefit the AME church, the local AME church in town. Frequently, this would be to build a new building, to maybe expand a building. So when Douglass is speech in Salisbury in February of 1880, he's doing that deliberately to help the AME church in town. The network that brought him to town was affiliated with, I really should know this, if it's the Baltimore, Philadelphia, or kind of Delmarva conference, but essentially the AME network on the Eastern Shore is who brings Douglas to Salisbury. And yes, and Douglas speaks in the courthouse, and as you mentioned, the newspaper account is very interesting in terms of what's so interesting with Douglas is how he commanded respect from people who I feel, you know, interpreting history, people who might not have had respect for any other African-American. And that is a very complicated dynamic that Frederick Douglass had to have, you know, lived with that responsibility. And when he's marshal, Frederick Douglass is also, he's serving as marshal on his visits to St. Michael's in 1877, Cambridge in 1877, also here in Salisbury in 1880. He's marshal. So, I mean, Douglass is the lawman. You know, he is with the full authority of the District of Columbia government, the president, et cetera. I mean, really, that's how Douglass is coming into town. So what was so fascinating is, so whereas newspaper articles that you alluded to might have been, you couldn't really disrespect Frederick Douglass. I mean, that's kind of really the what I'm trying to say, kind of being around the bush a little bit. No, is that, like I said, articles reviewing Douglass's speeches are very interesting because there would be in towns, Democratic, Republican oriented papers, and the coverage of Douglass's speeches would be very different. Yeah, the interpretation of the Salisbury newspaper, I would encourage people to go on the internet and look it up, is very interesting.
So, and he clearly saw the Republican Party of the time as the sole liberator for African Americans when it came to slavery. I think there was a quote down in front of me where he says he will be Republican till like the day he dies. Obviously, dramatic changes have occurred over the years. How important was Republican politics to him?
That's a great question, Don. There are some historians or some scholars that will really kind of take the interpretation of Douglass, whether it be like the Cato Institute or Brookings or et cetera, in terms of trying to kind of maybe put Douglass in, let's say, one box in terms of his views, his speeches, his quotes. And that's all fine, good, and well. I don't do that. But in terms of, because the question that you asked, which is a wonderful question, is in terms of when Douglass lived his life, he was definitely a loyal Republican in terms of he was a party man. When I say party man, Douglass went to the Republican National Conventions. I mean, all of the National Conventions, he spoke, he addressed the large crowd, which is significant in itself and historic in itself. For example, in 1892, Douglass travels to Minneapolis, Minnesota to go to the Republican National Convention. So I say that in terms of Douglass's allegiance and loyalty to the Republican Party was political in nature in terms of securing patronage positions or securing appointments for Frederick Douglass's extended network, whether those are, for example, the children of black abolitionists that Frederick Douglass knew coming up. For example, Henry O. Wagoner, who was a Marylander, Douglass helped secure his son's position as in the diplomatic corps in Paris. This is in 1874, so that was definitely a measure of the Republican Party because President Grant was, you know, president at that time. Douglass also, for example, I mean, even just in terms of his party politics, to try to maybe do a little Eastern Shore history, there's even people in terms of Frederick Douglass's, like I said, his kind of surrogate wife family that write letters to Frederick Douglass asking, you know, his assistance, and Douglass obliges and writes the agricultural secretary. This is in the 1890s, the letter saying, you know, can you help get this young lady a position, and this is how I know her. So Douglass was very conscientious about the importance of these government positions, not just for, let's say, you know, someone's own largesse, but in terms of, you know, making social progress through, you know, government positions, and also having, you know, someone who people in these positions who would be maybe more sympathetic or whatever in terms of their positions of influence is important to diversity is a trite word, but in terms of getting more equality in, you know, politics. And so Douglass's allegiance to the political party, I think, was because Douglass, you read earlier, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. Douglass also has a quote, I believe it says, like, basically everything personal is political, in terms of Douglass knew that, you know, in this country, the way to enact change is through politics. And Douglass's break with William Lloyd Garrison as a young man was really over the interpretation of the Constitution. William Lloyd Garrison was essentially pacifist, anti-government in terms of Douglas, William Lloyd Garrison was against political agitation. Frederick Douglass took the opposite position. He affiliated the Free Soil Party, the Liberty Party. These are precursors to the Republican Party. Douglass was politically active. And here in the Eastern Shore, there's a visit that Frederick Douglass makes to Denton, Maryland, in Caroline County in late October of 1883. And Douglass's visit to Caroline County is extremely deliberate in terms of there's a gubernatorial race. And there is a the Democrats are organizing in the state of Maryland, and Frederick Douglass is kind of called in by the local Republican Party in Caroline County. It's like, let's say, the big gun from Washington City. Douglass comes in and addresses the local Republicans in terms of trying to kind of, let's say, get out the vote effort. I mean, it wasn't necessarily called that in the time, but so Douglass is. I feel that maybe Douglass is, I'm not saying you, Don, because you're a sophisticated young man, but I'm just saying overall, I think the interpretation of Douglass as a Republican is kind of maybe it's explained in modern times, where if we look at the history of Douglass's activism, there's a history of his political activism. And I thank you for that question, because it is complicated. Douglass in his life, he like John Mercer Langston, for example, you know, runs for Congress in 1888. Now, it's complicated. I won't get into it. But Frederick Douglass opposes John Mercer Langston's election to Congress. And John Mercer Langston wins the election. And it's complicated. He serves for a short period of time. So, I mean, Douglass was someone who, I mean, it's just as today politics are complicated. They were just as complicated or more complicated back in Douglass's time. So I think that, you know, and it is beyond my area of expertise, yeah. But I think historians really should maybe take a closer focus at the mechanics of the politics. And when Douglass was in Washington, the dynamics were that Senator Blanche Bruce was the first African-American to serve a full term in the United States Senate. He was from Mississippi. Douglass was close friends with Blanche Bruce. They would go to the horse races together. They would talk finance, etc. And so it was just a different day in Washington City when Douglass was there. And I say that because there's an account of essentially Douglass working with Blanche Bruce and some other people in Washington trying to get a meeting with Robert Todd Lincoln. Robert Todd Lincoln, the son of Abraham Lincoln, who was serving as Secretary of State. And it was a dynamic where Douglass could kind of just walk into his office and, you know, have a couple minutes with them and discuss the mechanics of the politics, whether that's, you know, upcoming election or maybe what's going on in certain states or, you know, potential, you know, positions. So it really is fascinating to study Douglass politically, because I think it's something that needs to be done.
A much cozier time, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Finally, in terms of recognition of Douglass, particularly here on the shore, I mean, you mentioned a moment ago that obviously Cambridge, I mean, right after, certainly, Cambridge welcomed him. We know there's a lot of events going on in Cambridge. There's some great discussion that's been talked about in terms of Talbot County. Do you get a sense that the show of appreciation for Douglass differs from area to area?
Tough question, I know. That is a wonderful question, and I already am kind of viewed as a renegade historian, so I will try to answer that very cautiously. Well, first of all, I just wanted to give a quick acknowledgement to the St. Michael's Museum at Mary Square on Saturday, October 20th, from 5 to 7 p.m. I will be speaking at the Union United Methodist Church, Railroad Avenue. People can go to the St. Michael's Museum to get those tickets. Once again, that's Saturday, October 20th, at 5 p.m. I'll be speaking and presenting kind of on Douglass in D.C., Eastern Shore, kind of what we've talked about today. And then on Thursday, November 1, I will be at the Easton Branch Library, the Talbot County Library in Easton on Thursday, November 1. I encourage people, you know, please to come out, just continue this dialogue and discussion. But your question about different areas celebrating or recognizing, acknowledging Douglass, I think right. that the bicentennial is official in terms of Congressman Andy Harris here on the shore worked with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who I'm friends with, associates with. Congresswoman Norton is the real warrior on the Hill for the district. And Congressman Harris and Congresswoman Norton helped establish the Federal Bicentennial Commission that was kind of officially launched in February. I think that anyone who's a close observer will just say that I think there's some work that needs to be done, you know, on all sorts of levels, whether that's, you know, federal, state, local level. And it's really interesting on Douglas on a local level is here, for example, on the Eastern Shore. There are banners in Easton acknowledging Frederick Douglass. There are also banners acknowledging the Hill neighborhood that Douglass had a close affiliation with, which I think is terrific. You know, Talbot County, the Eastern Shore, has elevated and uplifted the Douglass Bicentennial, which is, I think, terrific. In Baltimore, there are also banners in Fells Point, which is a neighborhood that Frederick Douglass was closely associated with. Douglass escapes from Baltimore in September of 1838. And there's so many places that touch Douglass, and I've had the opportunity to do a couple events in Rochester. There are obviously things happening in Washington, Baltimore, the Eastern Shore. I think that, as like I said, that was kind of a dangerous question that you asked me, but I will say that I think that moving forward, there are a lot of opportunities for collaboration, for kind of just having a closer relationship between some of these Douglassonian communities. And so, yeah, I think that the bicentennial is going to kind of officially be acknowledged and celebrated until February of 2019. But I think that the Bicentennial Commission, I've had some discussions with people, and I don't think this is too controversial to say, but I believe that the legislation essentially creates it in, let's say, perpetuity. And I think there's a lot of work that can be done with Douglass, even here on the Eastern Shore. I think that the Harriet Tubman Underground, byway is really wonderful, and I think that Frederick Douglass potentially could warrant or merit a parallel kind of byway pathway that would have obviously stops in Cambridge, Dorchester County, Caroline County, Talbot County. So I think that, Don, it's a wonderful question. I really look forward to kind of just continuing this work and continuing to work with wonderful people and organizations, such as yourself, just to even get the word out. Because the media is someone that Douglass was not a radio man, but he was a good talker, but he was definitely an editor and a publisher. So, even the connections between local journalists, I think, is something that even needs to be made.
Hey, he certainly knew the medium of his time, I'll tell you that. Yes, we've been talking to John Muller. He's author of a book entitled Frederick Douglass in Washington, D.C., The Lion of Anacostia. Appreciate you taking time to speak with us.
Thank you, Don. Wonderful to be on your show.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.